Welcome to the Cocktail Lovers podcast. I'm Gary.
And I'm Sandra.
And together we are the Cocktail Lovers, a married couple sharing our passion for the artistry of drinks.
We've been writing about cocktails in our eponymous magazine and website, but this is where we talk about cocktails.
In each episode, we'll be sampling the best products from spirits and mixers to non-alcoholic tipples and pre-mixed drinks, highlighting our pick of the books to add to your cocktail library and shining a light on the bars to have on your radar.
We'll also be checking in with some of the biggest names in the industry to hear what's going on in their world, as well as asking them for their tips on making quality drinks at home.
We like to think of ourselves as your new best friends, cocktail-wise. So, let's hear what's on the show this week.
Every day is a school day here at Cocktail Towers, and, as ever, we've enjoyed our lessons on the people, places and products featured in this episode. We've learnt about the Heart Cut, the single-cask, small-batch spirits company founded by Georgie Bell and her partner Fabio, been tutored on Armagnac, courtesy of Marquis de Montesquieu, and genned up on sharpening our taste buds by studying Mandy Naglish's book, How to Taste, A Guide to Discovering Flavour and Savouring Life. Our bar pick is Wacky Wombat, where we get a geography lesson on the flavours of Australia, and Aurélie Panelou gives a masterclass on creating inclusive cocktail menus as she talks us through the three fabulous iterations of her maritime-focused Copper Bay bars, one in Paris, another in Marseille, and the brand new spot in the chic Home From Home, just off Champs-Élysées, Hotel Lancaster. But first, we are the Cocktail Lovers, so let's make ourselves a cocktail.
Right, so as regular listeners might know, and I do hope there are regular listeners.
I think there's one or two.
I hope so. So those regular listeners, they might know I've been on something of a mezcal journey for a while now. So I want to do something with a little bit of mezcal going on. And I was digging around and I found a Oaxaca Old Fashioned. I thought, hello. I'll give that a go. So as I'm talking, I'm putting in some ice into a couple of rocks glasses, because we always say simple drinks, great. And this is pretty simple. Just build it all in the glass. It's an old-fashioned. It was created in 2007 by a New York bartender called Phil Ward at Death & Co. And the reason he did it, he wanted to introduce at the time, what is that, 17 years ago? Wanted to introduce his guests to sort of a relatively new experience, which was mezcal. So he wanted to ease them in. So, right, so this is mezcal and tequila. So I've got my ice in my rocks glasses, one each. And I'm going first with 45 ml each serve of Reposado tequila. So that's going in.
You said one each what? One each ice cube?
No, one each. One for you. One for me. Because, you know, I thought it'd be
I hope just, so. I just want people
mix
to
one
know.
Up on myself and say, cheers.
No, I didn't know whether you were referring to the glass or the ice at that time.
Right. Well, let's just reiterate 45 ml.
Of Everybody, we're all clear
in
now.
Each glass. Likewise, with my mezcal, I'm doing 15 ml each glass. So measure that. There you go. And I'm almost there. It's that easy. So
that's quite nice to do a blend of both, isn't it? So I see what Phil was doing there, just like not whapping people around the face with the mezcal, but giving it a nice little gentle introduction to it.
Yeah, I think that's you just said it all. I mean, yeah, that's a nice gentle introduction. And as you said that, I've put in one bar spoon or one teaspoon even of agave nectar. And lastly, a couple of dashes of Angostura bitters in each glass. So two in that one, two in that one. Give each a little stir.
And that is, I mean, as you say, very simple, but also that thing, I love it when there's a drink that you can just make directly in the glass as
yeah,
well.
Absolutely.
Perfect for parties, picnics, all occasions, folks.
And lastly, in the original recipe, it does say flame some orange peel over glass.
You're not doing now, it? Not got your Bunsen burner out?
I did toy with a box of matches, and I thought, you know what?
No.
I'll set off the smoke alarm.
Yes.
And then what fun that would be. So instead, I'm just going old school.
It would make great sound effects.
Yeah, thank you.
Bit too much.
So I'm just going with old school with just a little twist of orange peel over your rocks glass. Hand it over to you. That is your whack old fashioned. Cheers.
Chin chin. Oh, cheers, Phil. So today we've got a lovely product here. It's called the Heart.
Yeah.
It's called the Heart Cut, and it's by Georgie Bell and her partner Fabio.
Right.
So it's their passion project, something that they love. They're real true spirits lovers, but they have a real passion for whiskey, so that's what they favour a lot more here.
Okay.
The name of the company, as I said, is The Heart Cut, but it means more than just a pretty name. This is the heart of the cut that distillers are looking for when they're producing their spirits. So what they're doing here, it's a single cask, small batch spirits company. And what they do, they're releasing one-off bottlings from distilleries around the world. So they're looking at large and small brands, but they're all specially chosen casks in collaboration with a partner distillery from somewhere far away, maybe. So they're looking at different things that you may not necessarily associate with whiskey.
So they're sort of doing the hard work
on their tasting travels. So they've got a few products at the moment. We actually have a bottle in, which is one of their blend number two.
Mm-hmm.
And it is in association with the East London Liquor Company. And it's a London rye whiskey single cask, one of 344 bottles.
Okay.
It says all of that on the label. So let me pass this over to you and
you
can
explain. Yeah, I like this bottle actually because it looks, is that 50? Yeah, I think it is. Anyway, yeah, it's a 50cl bottle.
Mm.
Yeah. But I like this design. It's kind of very pared back, very minimalist. Mm,
quite squat bottle, not necessarily what you think of as whiskey.
Yeah, and I like their little their logo on the front. This heart is like die cut into the label.
Mm.
So it's not like a heart and cheesy.
No.
It's kind of got a bit of attitude to it. So I like the design of this bottle very much, actually. So shall I pass it back to you so you can uncork?
Yes, and also they've got lots of another thing that I like about the label. All of the information is there. So it gives you tasting notes. It tells you where it's from. It has things like, with this particular one, it says, tastes like chocolate brownie, juicy black cherries, cocoa dusted almonds. I mean, what's not to like about that? There's also a QR code on it, so you can actually go to that and get the story of everything.
Yeah.
And it's really rather
lovely. I think you should crack it open.
I know, Gary, stop salivating. It's really unbecoming.
No, but I like the backstory, so I want to see the reality.
I know. Thank you very much. Okay, here we go.
Thank you.
So we've already been we've got a cue for the tasting note. So do you think chocolate brownie or no?
Well, I think the power of suggestion. But for me, it's lots of nice dry fruits, actually. Mm. That's what I'm getting on the nose.
That's really lovely.
Nice Christmassy cake vibe going on.
Yeah, exactly. And I love also, their website is really beautifully put together, very simple, very clean, but really informative. And the way they describe things, it's very engaging and very inclusive. So they have something like on there, it says, this made the cut because.
Oh.
And it says, imagine that first bite of a chocolate brownie. Well, East London Liquor Company have brought this to life through a collab with Hackney Brewery.
Mm.
our local distillery and one of our favourite hangout spots, they've matured their London rye in a chocolate stout cask, and we're over the moon to share this with you. So that's lovely,
nice,
isn't
nice
it?
And chatty, isn't
and
it?
And then they also give you pairing suggestions. And one of the other things that I love about the website, it says, if you like this whiskey and you want to go and visit the distillery, they give you some little cafes and bars and restaurants around the area that you might like to visit.
Yeah.
So it's nice and personal, but also really engaging. Now, I've said all of that. What do you think of the whiskey?
No, I think it is. I had a couple of sips there, and I like it. It's very light and approachable. Mm. And it's funny, as soon as you said about pairing suggestions, and I don't know what their pairing suggestions are, but as I was sipping it and you said that, I thought, oh, I bet this would be really nice with the little cheese selection. I can imagine having that with blue cheese or something.
Yeah.
But it's very, what I mean by that is it's very easy to drink.
Yes.
It's not, you don't have to sit and really ponder deeply over
yeah
it.
But that said, it's not, it's, yes, it's light and it's very approachable, but it is very complex as well, so it's a lovely balance. So it's a good one for whiskey fans, but as we like to say as well, for people that are having an intro to it as well. So I think that's around £65, but as I say, they're going to be adding different selection, different cuts throughout the year. And it's a really lovely website and a really lovely place to go for whiskey connoisseurs, but also newbies as well. And that's the Heart Cut. So please have a look at our Instagram feed and website for more details.
Over to me, and I'm going for Marquis de Montesquieu Armagnac. And I don't think we've done
Armagnac. I was just going to say, we've done Calvados, we've done so. But anyway, it's lovely. I'm so glad because I love whiskey and I love gin, but it seems that we have so many of those.
Yeah,
so it's lovely to have something different. So over to you.
I've got something different for you. So it's from kind of an old house, I think. It's been around since about 1936. But it's changed hands. There's been different people involved in it. I think significantly a few years ago, a guy called Alexander Steen.
Now Monkey 47.
Thank you very much. Yeah, so he's the guy behind, the German guy behind Monkey 47. And also we did his Horse with No Name
a few years
ago. So he's involved. And I think this might have something to do with the vibe. So I looked at the website and...
is it bonkers?
No. It's not bonkers, but it's not what you'd expect from, you know, a serious dark spirit. He says something about, interestingly, he talks about it being like rock and roll.
Right, okay.
And he also, they mentioned that thing about when people say, you know, how do you stack up cognac against Armagnac? And they on the website, they basically say, well, that's like comparing the Beatles to the Rolling Stones.
Mm.
And the takeaway from that is, well, they're both great, but totally different.
Yeah, but it's good. And it's relatable, that, isn't it? That sort of language. Yeah. I like that.
And it follows through on lots of websites. There's all these references to, like, Start Me Up. It's like Pop Master. Start Me Up is their backstory. They talk about Our House, as what they do. So I like all that. It makes it very approachable, which brings us onto the bottle. Let me hand you this bottle and let me have your thoughts on this.
It's quite interesting because when you go to our Instagram feed to look at this, both of the bottles that we've spoken about this week, there's a real synergy, actually.
Yeah,
they look like they could almost have come from the same stable.
It's a really bizarre
color. Yes. And they stack up. The colours of the liquids are similar. Yeah. And
but the
look and
shape.
Yes. But it's, again, it's lovely because it's not what you'd think an Armagnac, you know, because it feels... Armagnac, you say, and it's lovely, but it feels a bit fusty, dusty, a little bit old school.
Yeah.
But this couldn't be further from the truth. So it has got a cork stopper. It's short and stout. Not as short as the Heart Cut, but it's just, I love it. I really like the typography and the way that it's all been done. Beautiful.
Yeah, and it is that thing, I think, again, you know, picking up on the last product, it is that thing of just making these spirits more approachable and inclusive. And I really like that as a sort of philosophy. And I think, as you said, it's not fusty dusty. It's very, it looks like, yeah, this could be right for me. So let me, as I'm talking, I'll open up.
And
so,
that's another 50CL, isn't it?
It is. I think that's a really good thing as well. More and more products you can get in that size. Just to sort of, you know, get involved, see what you think. So this one, they do a VSOP and an XOP. This is the VS. So
VS is very special. Yes. Eh? That's what it stands for. And that's not me being funny. That's actually what.
So let me. What are you getting? What's it happening? What's happening for you?
What's it happening?
What's it happening?
Yeah, it's lovely. It's very Armagnac. Key? I don't know. I don't know what to say. There's a lot of raisins there.
Yeah, it's got a lovely light glow about it.
I say raisins because that's what I can immediately think of. But actually, to be honest, I don't know what I'm getting on the nose. Yeah. What are you getting?
After the whiskey we just had, this is very, very delicate. It's kind of got, it has got a sort of, I mean, like apricot. You know, I don't know what
dried
I'm
fruits.
Thinking.
That, dried
yeah, but yeah, the, but it's very, very delicate on the nose. So let go in for a little taste.
Taste is good. I love the taste. I just couldn't put my finger on any aroma in particular, but this is lovely. I do like this.
I know I overuse this expression, smooth, but you have to say this is smooth.
Yes.
I also like the mouthfeel. It's mouthfeel. It's one of those things you sort of want to roll around.
Well, you do roll. Yeah. Even if you didn't want to, it just naturally happens. It's a lovely one to explore the whole of your mouth with. So you want to roll it round your tongue, but also the roof of your mouth and everything. It's just really luscious, actually.
Are you getting as well? I'm getting, it's just a little bit spicy in the finish, almost like a rye whiskey. It's like,
yeah,
but not as intense. It's like a little
it's
bit
very
of
nice. I really like that.
So the other thing I really like about this on their website, and I think this is such a refreshing change we've noticed over the years. Of years ago, you know, your cognac, your Armagnac, your whiskies, they were all so exclusive. And, you know, the thought of mixing them in cocktails for a lot of people was like, oh, how dare you? People like this have gone in completely the opposite directions. And that's, and they've got some really lovely cocktail recipes for the for the VS on the website. They've really embraced it. And the other thing I really like, because we always said, as we were, when we were making the drink at the top of the episode, you know, simplicity at home particularly is great.
Yeah.
And so many of the cocktail recipes, they're really simple. They're like 2-3 ingredients. So for instance, they've got one mixing this beautiful Armagnac with creme de menthe for a stinger, with amaretto for a French connection, and this is the one I really want to try, a Metropolitan with sweet vermouth. So a kind of martini, Manhattan kind of vibe. So I really like this. It's very sippable, but I really want to start making cocktails with this right now.
And how much is that then?
This is, I should have said, sorry, by the way, it's 43% ABV, and it's £40 for
that's really
a
good
50cl bottle, which I think is really good. Get you into the category, get you want to sip it, get
and
you
it's something a bit
this.
Different, but actually quite familiar for spirits. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So
I
it's
think
lovely.
So. That is Marquis de Montesquieu Armagnac. And now for a cocktail hack from one of our experts.
My name is Christine Wiseman, beverage director for Bar Lab, and my cocktail hack is to make a shrub or a drinking vinegar. It is equal parts vinegar, sugar, water. And if you have anything that is going bad in your refrigerator, like berries or melons, different herbs, and throw in some spices, you can create a shrub that will extend the shelf life, and you can have it up for a couple, 2 or 3 months in your refrigerator.
So my book, we do lots of recipe books and things like that, but this one has really caught my attention. It's a book called How to Taste, A Guide to Discovering Flavour and Savouring Life. What's not to like about that?
And it's a different kind of idea, a different way of hooking you in, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, for some people like us, I find it really difficult to describe taste and also to think about taste, even though we do cocktail judging and we do all of these different things and just actually enjoying things at home. So that's also why this appealed, because it's like, how do you taste, you know?
So tell me more.
This book is by Mandy Naglish, and she's a certified taster. But I love the idea of it because it's not... As we say, we usually go for recipe books, but this covers everything from food and cheese to honey oils, taste in wines and spirits. But it takes you, I love this quote from the book. It's like, it transforms you from a person who eats to a person who tastes. So it's that appreciation of flavour and
that's really
interesting. Yeah, exactly. It's a book to sort of build on your tasting skills. And what she's done, she's interviewed expert tasters, including scientists, judges, perfumers, and things like that. And it describes a lot about how tasting works and the biology of it, including the way that your receptors work and all of the sort of olfactory things, which I think is really incredible. I haven't read all of it. I've skimmed through most of it and then zoned in on other bits, but I'm definitely settling down to read this book because it's
what's really
great.
Fascinating as well about all of this is that thing when people started to point it out to me years ago about the, you know, you think you're tasting something,
yeah, but it's a smell
it,
yeah,
and
absolutely.
Then they get you to hold your nose and yes, taste something, there's hardly
yeah
there.
So there's all of that kind of stuff in there. And it sort of talks about, you know, the basic flavors, you know, obviously, you know, sweet, sour, blah, blah, blah. And then the influence of geography and how terroir comes into everything as well.
Which is such a thing that people talk about more and more.
Absolutely.
Now,
but just to understand it, because sometimes we bandy words around and you don't even actually know what they mean. You sort of think you know what they mean. You know, so that's that. And then it talks about how your taste differs when you're in the air. I know that we've written about this, you know, like when you're 35, 5,000.
When you say in the air, you mean
on a plane,
flying,
on a plane rather than just sort of floating.
Yeah.
But you know, so I don't usually have a Bloody Mary, but a Bloody Mary is one of the things that you really go for on a flight because of the umami and also how your taste receptors change in the air. So there's all of that. It's got lots of things on flavor wheels and talks about how you build your library of taste. So your library of taste is going to be different to mine. And even where you are in the world, it's going to be different, you know. So it's building your vocabulary of flavors
and taste.
I like
that as well because, you know, sometimes when you do tastings with people and they tell you what they're getting and instantly it kind of throws you because you're either looking for what they're getting or you find it hard to get your own ideas.
And then also it talks about glassware. So we've done one of those lovely things with Maximilian Riedel where they talk about how the shape of a glass can affect the taste. And I think when we first did it, I was a bit skeptical, but we did it and it was like, oh my God, it really does
absolutely
work.
I remember that so well. Yeah. But that's in there as well, that sort of idea.
All of that sort of stuff and so much more. So as I say, I haven't completely read it, but I've gone through quite a bit of it, but I really want to dig into it a lot more because it's a heavy textbook. You know, you haven't got pretty pictures. This is a reading book.
Yes.
And I quite like that. It's not just about how you appreciate what you drink, but about the food that you eat and all of the stuff. So it's called How to Taste, A Guide to Discovering Flavor and Savoring Life. And it's by Mandy Naglish. And I think mainly it's available in the US at the moment, but you can order it through Amazon. Get your chops around this one, folks. The brand new issue of the Cocktail Lovers magazine is out now, and it's dedicated to the amazing women working in the drinks industry. From the change makers to the bar and brand owners and the men they've inspired, it's our way of saying that we celebrate women all year round, not just in March. To get your print or digital issue, or to start a subscription, simply visit thecocktaillovers.com/magazine.
Okay, so our bar reviews, right? I think they're getting closer and closer to the visits because when we did three sheets recently, I think we did it with talked about it the day after.
Yes, yes.
Now this,
we've just got back
less than an hour ago.
Hot footed it.
No, I know. Presumably the next one we'll just do while we're.
Why
there.
Don't we? Yeah. We should. Yeah. That will do. Okay, you lead on this one.
Okay, so where have we been? You ask. We have just been to Wacky Wombat.
Mm.
And this is an area we've sort of talked about a little bit on.
We keep talking about Soho.
But it's just turning into such a great little space. This sort of, you've got Dram, you've got Swift, you've got Three Sheets.
We keep saying that.
I know, but it's worth repeating, yes. Right? Yeah. And now adding into that mix, we've got Wacky Wombat, which is from Nico DeSoto. And it is, I believe, it's his third international offering,
yes, yes.
After Mace in New York and Danico in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
So we dropped in there. And when I say dropped in, it's a basement bar, isn't it?
It is. And it's quite funny because today is one of those rare treats that we have in London, a bright, sunny day. And actually, it would have been great in the evening. Today, it just felt like, whoa, this is really dark for an afternoon. But this is the space that it is. It's very subterranean bar.
Yeah. But I like that bar. It's very, let's talk about briefly about the look of the bar. It's quite smallish,
yes,
intimate.
But before we say about the bar, I have to say that it is a bit hidden and you do have to, you can't just chance upon it. You know, you have to ask where to go, even once you get into the restaurant. So, and probably on your first outing, you'll have to ask someone to take you down because it's down a real sort of long corridor and it could seem like, what is going on?
A long, dark corridor.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So it's a kind of almost a reintroduction to the age of the speakeasy without being a speakeasy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I just wanted to give a warning on that. Don't just, exactly. Heads up, indeed. That's the one.
So when we got through that corridor, our eyes adjusted from the sunshine outside to the nice ambient lighting in the bar.
Yes, very snug, very cozy, very dark, quite sexy. It's a very sexy space,
I think.
It also has a kind of, it felt a bit maritime to me. I know that we will be talking to Aurélie a bit later, and she has a maritime kind of theme going on there. But there's something, maybe it's the richness of the navy blue, and there's all these lovely, beautiful lighting and stuff going on that's very cozy, but also like at the bottom of the ocean, I would say.
Well, that's an interesting way of looking at it. I mean, also what I liked about it, it has got a bit of, you know, the look and the vibe. It's got a bit of a sort of grown-up nightclub.
Yeah, it does feel very nightclub. Yeah. And I must say as well, it has the most amazing sound system that you can tell that they have really tailored the sound. The sound isn't an afterthought. It's very carefully curated. It's loud, the music, but you can hear yourself and it really envelopes the room really, really nicely. I love the sound there, and whoever has come up with that, it's fantastic.
Well done.
Yes.
And it's, you know, the music they were playing added to that kind of nightclubby feel. It's sort of very downbeat groove kind of thing, and but they have DJs, I believe, certain nights, Fridays, Saturdays,
like, yeah,
so that would be worth checking out. So what else can we say? Let's talk about the actual
because of the group, the navies and stuff, there's splashes of blue and also little accents of goldy velvet banquettes and things like that. It's a very round room, which is really unusual. You don't usually get a circular room like that, but they've done it really well. Everything sort of anchors around this sort of tree sort of foliage thing in the middle of the room, and going around that you've got these tables and chairs that hug the walls, and it just they've done the design beautifully, apart from, I have to say, these very, very low chairs that I would never be able to sit in for longer than 5 minutes. They are super low. They look like little doll's houses. But we sat at the bar, as is our wont, and I'm happier for that.
Yeah, but it's worth worth mentioning. But yeah, we were at the bar, and at the bar, we looked at the menu, and it's a really nice menu. I believe it's going to change in a few months. But the thing is with the menu and the ethos, I think this one very much builds, is inspired by flavors and ingredients from Australia.
Yeah, because Nico is a very international bartender. He's one of his many accolades. He loves to visit all of the 50 best bars in the world. He's probably been to everyone, and also he is very influenced by his travels.
Yeah,
and so all of his menus that are going to feature here over the years, the months, whenever, are all going to be focused around flavours of a particular region. And he started off with this one from Australia, which is where I think he started his bartending career properly, in Australia, in Melbourne. So that's what this this menu all alludes to. So
And it's a nice menu. It's like almost the size of a little notebook that you slip
very
in
nice
your jacket pocket.
Design,
I really like the illustrations. They're really fun illustrations of a little wombat in various situations. He's in the city, he's in the country, he's flying, he's meditating, he's on a jar of Vegemite. So he gets around and they're very cute. And the other thing I really liked about the menu, before we get onto the specific drinks, I think we've mentioned before, it's kind of two things. Sometimes it's nice when they give you a little hint of the shape of the drink you're going to get. Like, is it going to be a highball, a martini, a rocks drink? So there's a tiny little graphic that lets you know that, which I think is always a nice thing. The other thing I thought was really good was all the drinks. Once you go past the very detailed descriptions of the ingredients, they're all described in two words. So every single drink you can look at, be smooth and complex or fruity and fizzy or whatever. And I think that's a good little nod, give you an idea of what you're in for.
Yeah.
So in terms of what we tried, shall I go first?
Yes, please. You go first.
So I went for Earlwood's Moussaka.
Because why?
Because as soon as I saw the word Moussaka, and then I looked and it's got, amongst other ingredients, a Moussaka spice mix. And I thought, well, you know, I really like to eat Moussaka. Mm. So, you know, is it going to be a key flavor? Is going to be a hint? So I was just so intrigued. I thought, I've got to have that. So it was olive oil washed blend of rum, red wine, the aforementioned Moussaka spice mix, tomato, eggplant, lemon and whey. So, you know, a lot going on in there. Served in a rocks glass with a big ice ball.
And a garnish of?
Of
a slice of,
yeah, of
aubergine.
Eggplant. But it was, what do you call that? It was not dried, it was
crystallized,
thank you, which looked very elegant. And
you say eggplant over here, we say aubergine.
That's true. I'm going by what was actually on the menu, so I'm true to that. But yeah, good for making that point. So in terms of what it was, I wouldn't say, oh wow, so it's really is like Moussaka in a glass. It's not.
Good, no?
Yeah. I'm not going to say that's good, bad, or indifferent, but that's what drew me to it.
Yeah.
But what I did like about it, and I guess this is from the Moussaka spice mix, it's had a kind of a little bit of a spicy umami kind of thing. But it's a really delicious drink, first and foremost. It's rich, had a lovely mouthful, but not heavy. And it was really, really flavoursome. It's one of those ones, you know, every time you go back and you have another little sip and think, oh, I'm getting more, and it's interesting. So I really liked my Earlwood's Moussaka. And yourself?
Well, I found it really difficult to choose a drink, actually, because it was the afternoon and I didn't want to go overly heavy because we've got lots to do today and it is the afternoon. And so it was just like the ones that I really were drawn to were the sort of deeper, darker, stirred down sort of drinks.
Yeah.
But no, I didn't. I refrained from that. And I went for, actually, this was the one that caught my eye first of all anyway. And it was called the Brazilian Wax in Bondi.
Yeah.
Why not? And it's fennel and bee pollen infused aperitivo. Beeswax infused cachaça, I can never say that properly, honey, champagne acid, salt, and champagne. And the lady, our lovely lady that was serving us, she sort of described it as an Aperol spritz, which it isn't, but I think that was the closest thing that she could, you know, familiarize it with.
Yeah.
And it does have components of that. Yes, it's sort of got this lovely pink hue to it, and it is served in a lovely, refreshing spritz style, highball, almost hybrid glass. And it has got that lovely bitter element to it, but it is lengthened and it is, the champagne gives it a lovely refreshing effervescence and it just feels really beautiful. And it's a perfect drink for a summer day. Really, really lovely. And Aperol Spritz drinkers would like it, but it's not sweet for Aperol Spritz drink.
Quite a lot more going.
Yeah, it was very nice. And it's a real crowd pleasing drink. I loved it. Really good.
And also talking of the fact you mentioned for summer, but we've already said this is a subterranean bar. What we did find out as well is there is going to be a little bit of terrace action going on in the next few weeks. So that will be, because that space outside is all pedestrianised.
Yeah.
You're off the main road. So I think a little terrace there.
And they're going to have a mobile bar upstairs. Serving those sort of drinks that I just had, which was the Brazilian wax in Bondi. And that's going to go down a real treat. I can imagine people having loads of those responsibly, folks,
of course,
in the afternoon at summertime. So that was really, really good. And then it would be really clever to do that because people could spend a few hours up there, maybe pop over to Three Sheets for one, then go back downstairs to Wacky Wombat.
Your evening.
And speaking of that, what do we think of that name?
Well, to be honest, when I first heard about it, when it opened, I was like I don't know, is it just a bit too comedy? But, you know, I think the thing with names of anything, let alone bars.
You just get used to them, don't you?
if the place is good, then you start to like the name. But if a place is really not so good, you start thinking, that's a really silly name.
Yes.
But this was a great bar, I think I will get used to saying, hey, I'm going to Wacky Wombat.
We have already. Yeah. So if you can find some pictures of it on our Instagram feed.
Aurélie Pialou is a native of Brittany, and her original passion was horse riding. But an accident led to a change of direction and making the decision to study cooking, bartending and management at hotel school. Moving to Paris, she went on to work at a range of luxury hotel bars before joining the legendary Le Forum, in the process becoming the first woman to work there in 80 years. Then, in 2014, she co-founded Copper Bay. Here, she expressed her passion for combining culinary techniques in creating cocktails to delicious effect. And we are so thrilled that she is joining us today to tell us more. Aurélie, welcome to the Cocktail Lovers podcast.
Bonjour. How are you?
Well, and really much better for seeing your gorgeous face today. So as Gary was saying in the introduction, you trained as a chef. Let's start with, when and why did you make the transition to become a bartender?
So actually, so as Gary says, originally I wanted to be a horse rider professionally. but then I got an accident just a year before moving to like high school and like specific schools. So I was kind of lost because I was like, I've never thought about doing something else in my life. There was a second passion, which was art, but I was like, maybe I don't have the level or I don't know what I'm going to do for that. And my best friend at that time was the same. She was like, we are 15 years old or 16 years old. How do you know sometimes at that age what you want to do later? And I was passionate about traveling and getting to learn other languages. And I was like, hotel keeping school might be something that I love because I have a couple of chefs in my family. I know about the industry. So I basically entered that school doing reception diploma. So actually I got couple of diploma. I got receptionist first. That was pretty fun, but there was not something made for me. I wanted something that moved a little more creative. So I started to like look at the other class, the chef's class. So I moved to a class where we do basically cooking, service, and then more like management. And after those 3 years, I moved 2 more years to get a specific diploma in cooking. But the point was like, I really loved it. I was like so passionate about it and I still. But there was something missing. And at that point, I was like, I don't know what was the thing. But then keeping on doing a little bit of like service as well, I was like, maybe it's the fact that you can really talk to people. You can really introduce what you're doing to people. You can also see their reaction, which is very nice. That's the thing that I love the most, like seeing people having the first bite or sip And then you directly see on their face if they're happy or no, if there's something going wrong or no. So I was like, okay, I think that's this part of like OSPO that I'm missing. And there were a lot of, in my hotel school, there were a class, a bartending class. There were just few at that time in France. There were about 30. But the diploma was actually a lowest level that my cooking room. So I went to my teacher. I started to talk with the bartender. And then I was like, that's the thing I want to do. Because I got everything that I love. I got the creativity part. I got the knowledge part about history and spirits. And I got to talk with people and to like exchange with them. And so I went to see my my teacher being like, okay, cool. I got my diploma. I'm super happy. But I'm going to move back down to do this 1 year class. And my chefs were like, why? I was like, they were like, you know that normally people that, I mean, we were in a class, like cooking class. We were very like, we're a bit of a warrior class. It was like, because you knew that if you were like top five, top three, you can choose all your trainings. So you can go to the best house for your trainings and stuff. So we were basically spending our whole day watching what the other were doing to do better on the next service. Or we were always kind of like arguing and trying to be like that top three. So that was very fun because we were a bunch super passionate about cooking. So we fight a lot to get, okay, we are top three and we don't want to move from that top three. So when I went to my teacher being like, might be bartender and not a chef, they were like, mm-hmm.
Yes, it must have been very bizarre.
Yeah.
But you found your passion. You found your happy place.
So I moved to that class. That was nice in a way because we were, at that time, there were just nine of us in the bartending class. So there was not much actually at that time. And also because I was the oldest, they kind of like helped me to schedule my program to keep on having like a third languages and to be able to like keep growing and learning as well on the other part, like out of bartending, because like we were still having like French and English. I was supposed to get German listening as well, but they were normally not on my schedule. So they had me some to like allow me to keep my level in languages as well. Got very lucky.
Love.
So obviously a lot happened there, but when you actually went out into the wide world, tell us about some of the venues and the experiences you had, the sort of places that you worked.
So I got very lucky first on class because when you do that kind of bartending class in France, you got two trainings a year. So the first one is about 2 months and then they send you for another one like 4 months later to another places. Then you can like really explore different style of bartending and like choose the one that fits you the most, which is very nice. It's a bit like cooking as well. You can do like classic French restaurants, but you can also do Star Michelin. And bartending to me is the same. You have to find the place that fits you the best.
Yes.
So I got very lucky because my first training, I was in Nantes in Brittany. At that time with a bartender called Mathieu Gouret. I'm still one of my favorite person in the world. It was my first bar chef in a way, and I was his first trainee ever. So I was supposed to go back home every weekend. Finally, I never get back home in 2 months because I loved it so much. And he introduced me to everyone, make sure that I was feeling comfortable with myself as a person and as a woman as well. So we really get that super strong link right now. And then for my second training, I moved to the south of France in Cannes. I was working at that time for Hilton there. And then after my scholarship, I moved back to work there for the summer because they proposed a job for the summer. And after the summer, I was like, okay, so what's next? And I figured out that if I want to keep learning and grow up, the easiest way, and it's sad to say, was to move to Paris because that was the place that had the most bars, that had the place that had the most opportunities. So I quit my little village in Brittany to move to Paris right after my season. I got the chance to be hired by the Hilton, the one which was on the other Triumph at that time. Now it's another hotel now, but start working with Stéphane Martin, which is very known in France for being now St. James Brand Ambassador, but it's really known for his cars, bartender as well. And I got very lucky because I start really as a bartender. And he basically arrived in the same time that me. So that was very fun because I arrived like 2 weeks before and then he arrived as head bar chef. And he wanted to like change everything. And he was the kind of person that, okay, he got this vision, he want to make it fast, he want to make sure that the collective is working very well. And for him, that was really the first point, the collective, and to make things move the right way and brings like some modernity to this like hotel industry. So we were like the second biggest hotel in Paris. So in terms of like rooms and guests and customers, you already got a lot, but the idea was to attract people from the outside as well. So we start to make like new menus and parties, DJ sets. There were like clothing sales in the bar, and then girls were also staying for drinks, and it was trying a lot of things. And also it was really cool because he really built that team. And I think that's the luckiest things that I have to see in my career is that wherever I've been, the bar team was always very strong together. I really got to grow up with people that were like, collective is the thing. You can be the best bartender in the world, but if you don't have the right person next to you, it doesn't work.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're talking about moving to Paris and getting that amazing opportunity to work and work as a great team. Apart from being at the Hilton, we remember going to Paris when we first visited Paris to try out the bars, which was about 10, 11 years ago. It was a very different scene to what it is now. Talk to us about what it was like at that time for you.
I think it was very interesting. There's something that people always tend to say now, sometimes being like, oh, before like all the independent bar that we are now, they were nothing. And that really upsets me a lot because I was like, it's not that they were nothing. There was just a different way. There were less for sure. I mean, there were less like independent bar. There was mostly like hotel bar or like family run bars such as Le Forum, as you say, La Closerie des Lilas, so more like classic American style bar. But they were not nothing. And if I choose to move to hotel, it's just because at that time also, the biggest opportunity as bartender were in a hotel. So that's why I work for Hilton, I work for Four Seasons, I work for W, because they were the places that were like having the strongest cocktail program, actually. Also the money to like help us to progress and like buy different things, be more creative. And so, yeah, that was more like there were independent bars as well, American style classic bar, and then hotel bar as well. So most of my generation of bartenders are actually born in hotel. Even though we all have independent bar now, like I guess most of the people from my generation, we've been through hotel for sure.
But that's great training though, isn't it?
Yeah.
In that setup, I think.
What about now? So sort of fast forward that sort of 10, 12 years or something to Paris now. How would you describe the bar scene in Paris now?
I think it was like 18 years ago, but don't tell anyone. Just let people know that I start very young. But I think it's a very vibrant scene, and I always tend to say there's not only Paris, because to me the French scene is not only Paris, and that's something that I really want to fight for as well, because there's amazing bar all over France in any city right now, and that's something that I really want to highlight as well, because like we always tend to speak about the main cities always in any country. It's like that. Yes, in any country.
Yes. Yes,
but that's not only what makes your scene. Your scene is the entire country, and much more when you go to a country like France with this like huge regional culture that really impacts the way you work. So for example, if you take Paris as an example, it's been changing a lot because there's been like a switch at some point where there were already independent bar, there were hotel bar, but there were not much communications about bartender. The focus was always mostly on the chefs and the sommelier, because that's the French DNA, I won't lie. I mean, you grew up in France with eating, drinking wine and beers, and it's not that people are not interested in, it's just that it's not our DNA, so we have to take everything back from zero and get to teach people. And I think the thing that was missing a little bit as well was maybe also French people that were like abroad and then came back to France and bring that culture and also the communication around it. So for example, if we take experimental cocktail bar, I think they were the one that really helps the industry by the fact that they were also really good at communicating. Plus, they have a super strong team that knows everything, and they were kind of like this like big cocktail vibe. And that really helps all the generation next. And they were kind of the one launching all this like independent street bar vibe. And if you see now, if you look at this now, there's like a lot of amazing bar all over Paris, all with different style, mostly owned by bartender, which is very important to me, because sometimes, and it's cool, you have bar. I mean, I think at that time, bars were mostly built and owned by people. They were not part of the industry and they were hiring like big bartenders. But now if you look at the scene, it's mostly bartenders that got associate with people and then they are managing their own place, which is makes a big difference to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Really, really does. And so that brings us nicely onto your bar, Copper Bay. So tell us a bit about it. You know, I want you to set the scene. How does Copper Bay fit into the picture of the Parisian scene, first of all? And then we'll talk about your three iterations that you have of the bar.
Yeah. I think I got very lucky because I'm not alone. I got two associates, Elsie and Julia. Yeah. And I'm glad two of them because without them, trust me, I won't have three bars now. We built Copper Bay in October 2014. So we're going to turn 10 at the end of this year. So that's a big year coming.
Congratulations.
I guess right now we don't really feel it. I guess it's going to be the day after we're going to be like, oh, you get kind of like that perspective being like, you've done that. Cool. You know, for the moment, it's not like the point. But so when we arrived, they were like a wave. So they were already like a couple of like, they were already a first wave before us of like new independent street bar openings, such as Candelaria, for example, who has the whole Quixotic groups. And a lot of people actually from experimental groups that after that opened their own places. And when I met Elfie and Junior, we were like, okay, we want this bar with a big Mediterranean vibe. Are very bright because, for example, there were this big vibe of speakeasy at the time, which is something that I like. I mean, I love to go to speakeasies, but if I have to work in a place and so welcome people in a place that we love growing up for them on the seaside and the ocean side, there's something which is very important, which is lights. And much more, yeah, and much more when you live in a city like Paris, where obviously it's expensive, so your place is always very tiny. And I think even as a bartender, when you work in a place which is a bit more like high ceiling and bright, when you work like 7 hours a day in a bar, it makes you feel more comfortable. So that was really the key point when we opened. We were like looking for a super like bright and high space, which was not the point at all when we opened. Like there were no bar with like huge windows and bright ceiling. And it was even harder for us because we're in Paris. Everything's Haussmannian and Haussmannian is not like big windows. So that was very tricky. And well, yeah, we had this Mediterranean vibe because, yeah, obviously Elfie and Julien are from the south, next to Marseille. And my Mediterranean DNA comes from a little bit more like from Greece, where part of my family is living. And I've spent some time when I was youngest and worked there. So that was really the idea to build a bar, which is like a neighborhood bar in terms of vibes, to make sure that everyone feels home, feels comfortable in our place. But having this like high level of drinks and large propositions. And of course, we also had the pastis DNA.
Yes.
Because pastis in France, actually, we talked about that a couple of days before. But the idea was that if you look at the French market, the spirits you find the most in every French house is pastis. That's the most popular drinks, but that's also the most convivial drinks. And that's really something that you can only find in France. I mean, the whole synergy around the spirits, the only the name dropping, like no one's name dropped spirits brands in France except for the pastis. If you grew up with this brand, you won't switch to another one. And yeah, that was just also the idea to highlight the fact that everyone's welcome. You can come in our bar. If you don't want to come, it's fine. It's no big deal. We just want people to have a good time.
And that was the thing, I must say, when I was there a couple of days ago, it's so beautiful because some people are drinking wine. Actually, most people were drinking cocktails. And then I'm not a great fan of aniseed, but I love the way that you served the pastis. It was very, you'd softened it, I think. It makes it easy for everyone to drink. And I think it was so lovely to have that as a welcome drink as well. So you've got great vibes in that place. It's beautiful, really lovely indoors, but also outside as well.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. No, it's just very important for us also to have something that reflects us. I mean, we always tend to say that you cannot please everyone, like neither in terms of design or style. But obviously, if any of our friends or people that we know get into that bar, if you look at the color code, if you look at the details, if you look at the drinks we have, if you really know us, you know it's us. There's no lie.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you go about creating your cocktail menus?
So we work on cocktail menus with the team every year. The particularity at Corporate Base that we never work from a spirit base. So that was a bit of a tricky thing to explain to the brand in the beginning, being like, oh, you already know you're going to have gin and rum on the menu. And I was like, nope, like that's really the things we choose at last. So the idea is that we always give neither a thema, neither a frame to the team. The idea is that, Corporate Base got this huge signature about working around like fit techniques or fit flavors into drinks. But also to make sure that on the way we're going to have the process and on the way we're going to explain what we do to people, we want to make it very easy to understand. Because I think at some point we've all done the mistake anywhere in the world that we were so happy to see our scene finally highlight. We were so happy to see that finally people were getting into cocktail. We were so happy to be able to prove that we were as good as other country that we make it complicated, but not just in the process, also in the way we written it on the menu or the way we explain it. And I think that's just the wrong way, because instead of making more people coming because they understand and they're proud of like being like, oh, I understand what I drink, and they tell everyone, they are like, oh, I'm not going to get a cocktail because I just don't get what's written on the menu. And I think it's kind of like counterproductive on that side. So that was also something really important for us. And so when the team works, yeah, we give this a frame, ideas or like ways. They made us propositions. Then after that, we're going to be like, okay, I don't know, I want a pancon tomate drink. Okay, what spirits going to be the one that works the best and that highlights the flavor profile we want to get? And then we do try out some like recipes. Of course, after that, the glassware as well, because it's very important. It's like a chef. If a chef dressed in a plate, in this plate, there's a reason on the back. It's not just because it looks nice. And then garnish. And then after that, we have the chance to have the exact same graphic artist that worked with us since the very beginning at Corporate Base, Sophia. And she's the one that designed the whole menu with us every time. And she's just amazing because she really understands the fact that we need to have something playful, but also like very easy for people to understand, knowing that people read less and less what you wrote on menus. So also like it's nice with the 10 years also to see how our menus have changed in terms of like our framing design, because there's a lot of things that we were doing at the beginning that we do maybe a little less now, because now we have like 10 years of point of view, so we can really like figure out what works the best and less.
And also how people use menus, because I'd love you to talk about the new menu that you've got. It's really, really cleverly put together. It's clever, but not complicated. It's very simple for guests to use. So can you talk about it, actually?
Yeah.
Tell us about what it is and how it works.
So our new menu is called Texture. So the idea was to highlight the fact that every single cocktails can have a different texture. It seems very easy for us bartender to talk about that because, I mean, that's our job. But when you talk to someone that's not part of the industry, it's very fun to see that when it comes to eating, people are really able to identify the fact that it's not crunchy enough, or it's not creamy enough, or it's not this. But when it comes to drinking, a liquid is a liquid. And that is sad because, yeah, like, no, a liquid is just not a liquid, you know, like it can have different texture, you can perceive it on different way. The fact also that bartenders, sometimes we shake, sometimes we stir, sometimes we throw, impact the texture or pre-batching or not. And that was the idea behind that, was really that to show people that liquids have different texture, and also to, like, say, like teach them about the fact that also if we use different techniques, it's not just to show off. There's a purpose on the back. Yeah, there's always like kind of like an educating side about it. So, for example, the first menu we've got, the first couple of years, there was always the same design. They were always like the glassware, because it's very important for people to identify the glass they're going to have. Of course, the price and the name of the drinks with a little, like, let's say like 5-6 sentence text to explain where the inspiration come from. And there were always 3 degustation notes to make sure people can kind of like imagine what they're going to get. And then on the bottom, there were always a cheese with all the ingredients of the drinks on the side. And every single ingredient was related to a color of the cheese. Then where people, when they were looking at the cheese, they were like, oh, for example, there's tomato. And tomato is, let's say, like 25% of the cheese. So you're going to taste tomato a lot. So that was really easy for them to project what they're going to get into your drinks, even though some ingredients, they didn't know them. Or even though some ingredients were always a little more complex, they were like always 1 or 2 complex things. But I think it's very helpful because if you go into a bar, and I think as bartender, it happens to me as well, which is even weirder because when you're a bartender, you're like, and you don't get what's on the menu, you're like, holy shit. But like it happens to me a couple of years ago, and I was like, what the hell? Like there were one drink, I was like, I have no clue about what it can taste at the end. But I say, if I don't understand, just imagine someone that maybe had his first experience in a cocktail bar. You got 2 options. Neither you have something super curious, someone super curious, and he's going to try out, maybe going to like it or not, but I'm going to get into it. But most of the people, they're going to be afraid. And if they're afraid, neither they're going to go for something they know, let's say a classic, which is fine as well, or neither they're going to go for a wine, a beer, or something else, just because they're afraid. Or neither they're going to try out, they're going to hate it, and because they hate it, they're going to say, oh, I don't like cocktail. But it's not that you don't like cocktail. It's just that maybe we don't make the job to make sure you understand what you're going to get, and we doesn't, let's say, explain you the right way so you haven't make the right choice for you. So I think it's very important.
Tell us that, so that's how why this menu is very clever, because you've divided it into things like pulpy and oily and whatever. And then also each page, there's a texture that people can feel.
Exactly.
So they get the feel and look of the drink. Tell us a little bit more about how that works.
So the idea on this menu is, so as I said, we're working on texture. We've worked on perception, like visual perception 2-3 years ago. And that was the one we really wanted to try like this time. And same, we were always like, okay, let's make it like, maybe it's complex in the technique we're going to use, but we have to make sure people are going to understand it. And maybe people are going to be able to try things they will have never tried before. And I think if you want people to make things they've never tried before, you have to be playful on the way. So my associate got the idea of like, okay, we need to make it texture. So every single drink's going to have a texture name. So jelly, pulpy, fizzy, oily, creamy. So pretty easy to understand for everyone. Doesn't matter the languages as well, which is very important. And then you have 2 options. So on each page, of course, you have same, the drinks, the price, the glassware. But then we recover this part with a texture to touch. Because first of all, we felt like it was very fun for people. And if you make things fun, you make things easier for them to understand. And also the fact of touching something is the easiest way, no matter you are, no matter you're from, no matter how you grew up, no matter, maybe someone going to show up in the bar and is blind. If you're blind, if you touch, you can understand. If you have any, like, I mean, we all have a different perception of everything. It's normal. Like, as we talk previously, if I told you blue, you will never imagine the same blue that I imagine, which is normal. And so touching is one of the only way where everyone gonna get the point. So it was very important for us to make sure that, yeah, everyone is more than welcome. And it doesn't matter who you are, you will get the point.
It's fabulous. So that's the Copper Bay Paris, but you've also got a new, well, we'll talk about, you've got Marseille,
mm-hmm.
But you've also just recently opened at the Lancaster, at the Hotel Lancaster as well. How do each of the bars differ and how do they come together as one?
Actually, it's a little family. Like if you saw corporate person Marseille, there's no doubt you're going to have the link. I mean, at the moment, we do have the same menu. The design and the details of design are exactly the same in Paris and Marseille. The difference is just the color codes. In Paris, we have more deep blue than turquoise. In Marseille, we have more turquoise than deep blue, which is normal. It's Marseille. There are more sun and there's more like, yeah, everything. They are more like in a nice internal weather. And yeah, that's the whole, the DNA and the vibe is still exactly the same. That was a bit more challenging at the Lancaster, for example, because it's a double DNA. It's not just a corporate bay, it's a corporate bay Lancaster. So the idea was, it's like a wedding when you marry someone. You need to have a little bit of both, you know. And it needs to also be relevant for people when they get into the corporate bay Lancaster to be like, okay, that's from the corporate bay, or that's like a little detail. So we work, menu obviously was very easy on that side. It was very easy to like step by step, give our approach to people and launch menu that people were understanding, and Mediterranean as well. Of course, there's pastis on the menu and our gin, house gin on the menu as well at the Lancaster since the very beginning. If you come to the Lancaster, you want the pastis, it's absolutely no problem at all. And in terms of design, you can see it very little touch. Same blue. There's the same blue that at the Copper Bay, both of the Copper Bay. The exact same one. There's this huge table d'hôte. So if you come at Corporate Paris, this on the first part of the bar, because we have back rooms as well and a room downstairs where you got bigger table. But in the main piece facing the bar, which is flat, because our stations in Paris and Marseille are designed the same way. It's a flat bar, like an open kitchen. That makes it more convivial. That makes it more like a easy for people as well to like sit at the bar, and whenever they see you working, because they saw every move, they saw everything you do, they got more interest and they ask more questions. So it's also a way to engage people into what you're doing, which was same when we opened Corporate Paris, like station like that, even in Europe, there was like maybe one or two, but not even more. And we did the same at the Lancaster. Instead of having this wooden station, we have this beautiful marble than they have since the very origin of the hotel, and we integrate a station, half round station on the back, which is flat as well, like a chef table. It's the same, you can get the same experience on that side. And facing that, so stations in both of our bar, we got this big table that we call tableau d'hôte in French, hosting table. And we did one massive one at the Lancaster as well, to really also have this vibe that if you want to sit down in a comfortable sofa, you can. But if you want to have a big table with all your friends around, if you want to sit, you can sit. If you want to stand up, you can stand up. It's more alive, it's more vibrant. And we have this massive olive tree as well in the middle of the bar, the Lancaster. So we cannot make more Mediterranean on that side.
How actually did the partnership first come about between you guys?
Yeah, because it's the first independent bar with the hotel, isn't it, in Paris?
Yeah, because the point is that, yeah, there's not much people that know that, but like, because it's normal, like when you watch all the scene all over the world, and you never really identify who's behind bars, or you identify the bar managers or the owners, but like, you don't really know how it works. Corporate Bay, for example, we build it with our own savings. We have absolutely no one on our back. It was just the savings of Virginia and I. So not the same when you build things on your own, because of course, when you open a bar and you have less money, in terms of budget, it's always tricky. So there's a lot of things we've done ourselves, like really a lot, which is cool because people don't really see it when they get into the bar, but sometimes when they are, like, oh, I love the color, I love this, and they're like, yeah, we've done it. <It's cool>. You're like, yeah, someone's like happy about what we've done. And so being in a hotel, that was really like, we met people from the Lancaster, actually. Alfie, my assistant, knows people from the Lancaster Hotel. They went to Copper Bay and they find out that they needed to have a new impulse in terms of bar. So in 2021, we did a pop-up for Christmas at the Lancaster Hotel. So actually, I was working there for 2 weeks doing Copper Bay 10th menu at the Lancaster. And following that pop-ups, we have a massive discussion with the hotel, and they were like, actually, we need to have a real bar. It's cool. I mean, people love it and enjoy it, and it really brings something else. And so how can we make it work? So how are we going to just consult for the bar? And they were like, no, we want a copper bay because the DNA fits our DNA. And the idea is that the Lancaster Hotel is a five-star hotel, but in terms of like room, it's not like huge. People that go to the Lancaster, they never call it a hotel. They call it the house, which makes us very happy because for us, it's something very important for us, hospitality at Copper Bay. So having a hotel that have the same mindset is very interesting. So we were like, okay, both of the DNA fits in a way. So there's something to do. So we decided to actually do a huge collaboration with them, which is not just consulting, which is a Copper Bay Lancaster. So both of the DNA in the same place. And boast the same level of decision as well.
It works really, really well, I must say.
Thank you. New challenge. It's challenging. It's good to be back in hotel, but it's very challenging.
Yeah, exactly. So how do you describe the Copper Bay philosophy in three words?
Mediterranean for sure. Hospitality at heart, for sure. That's something I will never give up on. And the third one, I'm torn between like free drinks and pastis, you know. It's like,
We're putting you on the spot.
Yeah. creative.
Yeah, creative inspiration, but yeah, also like the pastis side. I mean, we just want people to feel good in our places, you know, like I guess it's very important. I mean, it's always been about, I mean, we're all about techniques. We know it all over the world. I mean, it's very important for all of us. But finally, what makes people come back to your place? It's not only the techniques. It's the hospitality. You can have the best bartender in the world in front of you. If the person's not talking to you, if the person's not keen to share with you how he makes it or like just talking, you will never come back.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the perfect way to end it. It's fantastic. And that is why we always say at the end of each episode that, you know, you have to visit the bars, that the people that we're talking to for a reason, because we love them, we love their passion, and we love their style. So we urge you, if you're in Paris, please go and see Aurélie and the team in any of the bars, any of the two bars. And if you go to Marseille, definitely pop into Copper Bay, Marseille as well. Thank you, Aurélie, so much for your time. Always great to see you.
Thank you for inviting. That was so nice speaking with you. Hope you guys are going to enjoy it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Cocktail Lovers podcast. We really hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please tell your friends. And make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. For more details on the people, places, and products mentioned today, head over to our website, thecocktaillovers.com.